Hi, and welcome to the Podcast Companion and the podcast part of the Pedagogy of Playbook Companion. My name is Savannah Schulz, and I'm here together with my pop colleagues Jen Ryan and Mark Kruszewski to dig a bit deeper into aspects of our book. And essentially, this is a little team meeting time, so we'll chat a bit about play, playful learning, and questions that were brought to us by the community. And an old team tradition, I thought it would be really nice to start with a replay. And for those of you that are not familiar, this is something that for the longest time we've been doing during our team meetings, and especially at the beginning of team meetings, to share something that has been playful in the kind of recent past, also to help us get into a playful mindset. So it's a really nice way for us to enter meetings to talk about play. And it also gives us this opportunity to mention things and share things that might hinder us in being playful during that day. So things that are affecting the way we're thinking during that time. Mara, could you start us off with a replay and maybe also share a few words about kind of your background and who you are?
Sure. So I'm a senior researcher at Project Zero at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. I've been there for 40 years. I did a lot of work on Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences, and I've been a member of the Pedagogy of Play research team for the past 7 years. And probably the work that I've spent the most time on is a collaboration with educators from the municipal preschools in a town in northern Italy called Reggio Emilia, and that project was called Making Learning Visible. So for my replay, lately I've been doing puzzles from the New York Times. Like there's a puzzle called Wordle and another one called Connections. And there, I never want to not do it. Like it doesn't take that long. It adds this little moment of fun to my day. It's challenging, but not too challenging. And I share my answers with my daughter and an old friend online. And it's just such a nice addition to my day-to-day life.
Oh, I want to be part of that. I'm also a wordler at heart. Jen, do you want to share?
Also a wordler. Sure. So just a little bit about my background. I've been at Project Zero for, I think it's 18 years now, and I've worked on a number of research projects on maker-centered learning, on digital ethics in young people's lives, on the arts and education, and I've been with Pedagogy of Play since its beginning in 2015. My background is really in the arts, so I was a museum educator. I did a lot of work with school community partnerships in education and arts organizations, but am really a researcher in my head now. So my replay this morning, actually, Mara and I set out from Billund, Denmark, and had to make our way by walking, bus, train, bus, and then finding Sav in the middle of the street here in Aarhus. And it just reminded me how much fun it is to be lost and to wonder if you're ever going to make it to where where you think you need to be. It was very playful.
That sounds wonderful. And I'm great you found, like glad you found me. So my name is Savannah, as I mentioned earlier. I'm a reflection researcher based here in Aarhus, Denmark, and I'm very happy that you joined me over this side of the pond, since the Pedagogy of Play team is normally based in Boston in the US. And I joined the group around 5 years ago. I got adopted by Mara to do some work on reflection and playful learning with our kind of school teachers and students in Billund that we did a lot of field work with. And since then, I've been working on a PhD on understanding reflection and learning. And my replay, I have a one-year-old at home, so my days are filled with playful quests and toys, but I think that that's an easy out. So my playful thing is yesterday I went to the supermarket to buy some snacks for our recording day today. And in Denmark, we have something called Sweets Friday, I guess is what we translated. So slick is a big thing here. And on Fridays, families go to the supermarket, to specific supermarkets, and they fill up their bags with sweets from this kind of pick and grab station. And when you get to the till, you can roll the die. And then if you roll a 6, you get the sweets for free. So yesterday I was walking past the sweet counter. I wanted to grab us some licorice and then I saw it and I was like, oh, I have to do it. Like, I need to get into this playful experience. And when I was at the till, I was rolling the die. I could hear giggling and like people loudly exclaiming, "Rah! I didn't get the six, I got it." And I rolled the six, so I was very excited. But it wasn't the six that made it playful. It was this kind of being part of this experience of everyone, like adults. There were the grandparents next to me who were doing it very excitedly. So it was this kind of shared communal experience of playfulness that I really enjoyed. And we can enjoy the fruits today of it. So it's a very nice sweet basket. Maybe I should add something here as well, is that we normally do this replay with a lot more people. So today it's the three of us from POP, but we're quite a large group of Playful Minds. So if you're interested in who else is part of POP, you can look inside the Pedagogy of Playbook. If you scroll through the last page, there's kind of a little blurb about each of us authors. And then there's also a few more members that actually didn't co-author the book with us. So if you go to the Pedagogy of Play website, you can find some details about who they are, what other works they're doing, and kind of dig a bit deeper into the work there. But we're here for a reason. We're here to talk about play. And I thought what we could kind of start our conversation with is this common question we get during workshops or this online course that we're teaching on how do I balance play and learning? So how do I even make time for introducing play into the classroom? What do you guys normally answer when you hear that question?
I find that I often share a quote from a colleague and friend of ours, Susan McKay, who ran a school called the Opal School in Portland, Oregon in the U.S., who says, play is a strategy for learning, not just a set of activities you need to make time for. And I find that really, really helpful. I don't think every time you play, you learn. So the question is, well, when does it become learning? And I think understanding play as one of many strategies for learning, it's not the only strategy and you're not going to always use it, but it's a powerful strategy that is often overlooked for a variety of reasons in schools.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, you know, when we're talking about play as an approach, it's often how you're teaching something. So you can have the content that you're teaching, you can have the learning goals that you're teaching, you can have the specific outcomes that you're looking for, and teach it in a certain way that feels playful for both you, the educator, hopefully, and for the students. And I think one of the examples that I often share is from primary school teacher at the International School of Billund, who was teaching how to make sounds with her students. She was recognizing herself that she was incredibly bored with the kind of lesson that is often taught in that, you know, you say something, you repeat it, you read it off a card. And so she was challenging herself, like, how can I make this a little bit more playful for my students? And what she ended up doing was allowing students to create these incredibly ridiculous, very long combination of sounds and made up words, which was very playful for the children, very playful for the teacher, and at the same time, it got them really thinking about what those vowel and sound combinations were. So that to me is a nice example of like how you can hold on to those learning goals, how you can hold on to those outcomes and do it in a playful way.
Yeah. And I think that the follow-up question that we often get to this is, okay, if I do that, won't this introduce a lot of chaos into my classroom? What do I do about all the mess by letting those children loose?
Not sure I would agree with that premise, that it always introduces a lot of mess. I mean, if play is a strategy for learning, not a set of activities, I think the mess sort of is maybe thinking more about the activities. But on the Pedagogy of Play project, we also talk about paradoxes. Whenever you bring play into schools, you're going to encounter a number of paradoxes, like school is a place of order where it's often important that there is quiet, whereas play involves noise and maybe chaos. In school, learning is often determined by the teacher or standards, whereas play is often led by children. It's not one of those is right and one of them is wrong. They're both valuable, And they're always going to exist in tension. And so the question is, how do you negotiate between the two? So there may also be a little bit of an implication in that question that mess is bad or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think sometimes it is messy and it is loud and it is chaotic. And sometimes it's a matter of like changing your vision of what learning looks like and what learning sounds like and maybe what learning smells like. and recognizing that there's learning happening through those moments, you know, that you're still meeting those whatever goals are, you're still meeting those.
Yeah, I feel very seen sometimes with these sayings. I'm teaching at university where I feel learning can look very restrained. Mm-hmm. I enjoy being in the primary classroom to see it can be a bit more wild. So I think my response to after is that it takes small steps and giving yourself the okay to say no sometimes. And it's a lot more about you letting go than the students. So trusting your students to act responsibly with new material, trusting yourself to be able to respond to it. As part of the group, and I think this is growing out of an ISB study group, is the Say Yes to the Mess tool. So which gives you some guidance on how to enter into saying yes to the mess. So kind of if you're asked by a student, can we do this outside? Can we do this with water paint? Like how can we respond to this? And then going through the steps of, okay, why are you saying yes or no? Also allowing yourself to kind of consider what other options are there, or sharing with the kids or with adult learners, like why am I actually restrained in saying yes? Like what am I worried about? Actually sharing that, and maybe you can come together up with an idea of how you can solve it. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can say, well, I'm really worried this classroom is going to look like a mess afterwards. So how can we ensure that that won't happen if I say yes? And then giving a space to evaluate that as well later on, to say, well, how did that go? Maybe it didn't go well. That's fine. Like, let's rethink and restart from scratch. But maybe it went really well. And then you can see kind of what made it go well in the best place.
Yeah. And I think another tip in that tool is to think about, is what you're saying yes to connected or potentially connected to your learning goals? And that's sort of a helpful guideline for when to say yes to the mess.
I think that's great, because I think sometimes it might not be. I mean,
that's right.
You know,
it's not anything goes.
Yeah, exactly. And so sometimes you might not want the chaos or the mess or the noise or the, and sometimes that might pull you away from what you're trying to do in your classroom. So going back to what you were saying about navigating these paradoxes, I think having the learning goals in mind while you're thinking about being open to opportunities for, you know, blowing things up in some ways, you know, exploring different ideas.
I actually, to prepare for this recording, I also asked the wonderful socials about kind of what questions they would have for us. And I think what we just discussed about really fits into the question we've got from Susan D. Bloom, who is an author of this wonderful book called Ungrading, which really thinks about how can we kind of think about grades differently and remove them from university schooling, especially. And she asked us, so how do people incorporate notions of play in higher ed? And I think we will get to the question of adult playfulness in a different episode. But the second question she has, how do you acknowledge widely differing abilities, tastes, ages, bodies, backgrounds, and identities in play? And to reframe her question, I think it's really about how do we navigate as teachers that what is playful to one is not playful to all. So I really enjoy climbing. Not everyone will. Mara is an excellent like limerick writer. It's a challenge for me, so it can't always feel playful to engage with that. So how can teachers facilitate play to a broad classroom where not everyone will find playfulness in the same ways?
So that question came up when I was working with a study group at the International School of Bieland for a first grade teacher. And she had set up a puppet theater or a dress-up corner. And she realized that while that was incredibly playful for the girls, the boys really were not that interested. And so, again, she was realizing what's playful for one is not playful for another. So one kind of lesson that she took from that was perhaps you can't offer something for everybody, but maybe at least two, right? At least two different things, so you're not making an assumption that everyone will be equally interested.
That question always brings me back to the idea of low floors and high ceilings. Mm. So I think the way to often address that you have a classroom of differently able, differently interested students is to find a way to facilitate exercises that the students can have agency within and that they can design kind of niches for themselves where it feels playful to them. So to not only cite the ISB school, which we've all been exposed to a lot. So Mara and Jen are currently there. So I think that's also bringing them back into our minds. Is in South Africa, we have this wonderful example of a teacher trying to introduce an exercise, and I think it was about species, so learning about kind of what different elements of a species exist. And she invited her students to create their own species, so engage in kind of a fictional character and really fine-tuning for themselves what felt safe and what felt kind of comfortable. So students could create a South African animal. That was kind of a small tweak on an animal that already existed, but they could also go wild. And it really allowed the students to kind of enter the space very safely. They could just copy and paste something that they feel comfortable with, but they could also really go out and play within that experience. And I think that is really good examples of thinking about exercises as kind of open-ended. So where could students take this? Scratch as a platform is an incredible example of this in the digital space, where students can really think about building something and building on the abilities that they have at that current moment. So I think especially when we think about students with different skills, it's really nice to have open-ended designs.
Mm-hmm. That's also making me think a lot about maker-centered learning classes and opportunities when you have small group work around creating, whether it's design challenge or building something, and oftentimes setting up different roles for different students in those kinds of spaces allows different abilities, skills, interests for the children. So some children might really like sorting through material, and so they can collect material for the build. Some children really like building. Some children might really like watching what other people are doing, so they can have a role of documenting or making drawings of what they're seeing happening. Some children might really like going around the room and seeing what other people are working on and bringing that back to their group. So just setting up different opportunities, different ways for children to engage in those kinds of activities.
And also, we recently as I think 2 or 3 years ago, went on a trip to Reggio Emilia that Mara mentioned earlier. And there they really draw on documentation to bring forth kind of the interest of the children, to have them visible to the community and to be able to to respond to them. In our tool set, kind of our toolbox, we have expert books that really help with that. So kind of designing a little book for your class, for your study group, for whatever you have, where you can draw out kind of what expertises do you have in the group, what interests do you have, so that you can actually draw on that and say, hey, you were really interested in the Middle Ages and you know a lot about it. Can you help us share that with the other group? So I think often collaborative excitement can really help. And I'm not a big interested in computer games often, but I do watch it a lot with my brother to have shared time with him. So I think that that can be spaces where we can kind of also connect with each other.
Yeah, one other thing that we mention in the book is if you think about the learning process as having at least three components, and each one of those you can introduce the element of choice. So what is it that you are studying, and giving children or students the choice of within a topic, what are they particularly interested in? Secondly, how they go about learning it. And again, you can choose what works for me, which may or may not work for you. And then the third component is how you show what you know, or assessment. And I remember a secondary school teacher, for two of his students, writing an essay was something that they rated very highly on the fun scale. So You really can't make assumptions about what people will find playful.
And that was a scenario he gave children or students the option of how they want to show what they understood or what they learn.
He used to do a play and kids would take roles. And he thought, of course, this is going to be very engaging to mm-hmm. the whole class. And then when we were actually understanding and realizing that what's playful for one isn't playful for another, he thought, okay, maybe I should give them a choice. Yeah. And that's where he discovered that.
But I think that it all comes down to accepting that it's okay if it's not playful. Mm-hmm. And we often have this in team meetings. We try to be playful, but sometimes there's topics that we just don't engage in. So let me ask a question from Susan Axelsson, who is this play activist, pedagogical consultant, and writer from Sweden, who's been doing a lot of thinking of kind of free play in education. And she has asked us, what is kind of the role of agency and choice in playful learning? So she says, is autonomous play possible in a pedagogical setting? If so, do children get enough? Is all play viewed through a pedagogical lens? If so, how does this impact the way we view the play and the child in ourselves?
I think one of the things that we foreground whenever we talk about play in school is the connection to the learning goals. And so, you know, is it enough? I would have a hard time answering that question in a decontextualized way. I'd want to know, well, what were the learning goals for whatever the experience was? So I'm not sure I could generalize about that.
And I think we have quick answers to that, but we do think autonomous, or I would maybe use the word free play here, mm-hmm. since I'm more familiar with the term, it can exist, and it can exist at the same time as guided play can happen in school. So we can have recess and engage in free play, and we can have guided play during a math class, and they can coexist. And I think, yes, of course, if we enter any context into an educational setting, it needs to be redefined and reconsidered. And I think that's what we've been trying to do with the indicators, to really be very explicitly kind of intentional about how we use the words play. And with the learning communities that we work with, define, okay, what do we mean by play in this specific setting? And depending on the context, that can look different. So in South Africa, we found that Ubuntu, which is this concept of being through other people, is very important, where in the US that wasn't, of course, present. So I think our answer to that is, yes, you will always need to define what you mean by the word. And I'm guessing that this is also referring to this lifelong debate of free play or guided play. And I would say that we don't see a difference as much. Like, there's no dichotomy between those two. They can coexist, and they're not on either side of the spectrum. So hopefully that's answering your question in some way. And building on that, for the last question, we've got a question from Esther Federspiel, who is a psychologist, lecturer, and researcher within the field of informatics. So a very uncommon question, which is wonderful. So in which context does it make sense to apply gameful learning? In which context or for which goals does playful learning make sense? And I think we've addressed some of that already. But perhaps, so before we go into that question, we should shortly acknowledge the relationship between play and games, so which often comes up in Denmark. Actually, we have words for those. So we have kind of a word for free play, which is we lyre. And then if we engage in games, we spiele. So we can differentiate between that more. But in English, we don't have that. So there is play and there's games. And what we mean by play, we define in our indicators. But what is often referred to as game-based learning is this idea that you introduce actual games into a learning context. So students could engage in a board game that is about learning. There's this wonderful work by Val Shute, who has introduced Plants vs. Zombie, a computer game, into math classes to engage in probability thinking, because you have to think about what is the cost of a certain character, what is the consequences that it has. And it's much more enjoyable for children to do that than do the kind of traditional role dialing games. And then there's also this context of gamification, which refers to this use of game design elements in a kind of non-game context. So that can be digital or non-digital. So if I want to gamify my classroom and I want to gamify this podcast recording, I would introduce kind of level designs, badges, kind of elements of games into a context that has nothing to do with the game. So saying all of that, so this question is about, in which context does it make sense to apply gameful learning? And I think our quick answer is we didn't research that, so it's very hard for us to answer. But we have thought about how you can introduce digital context into mm-hmm. your classroom.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the gamification context, but I think hearing you describe it, it feels again, like an approach to learning. So if you have goals that you're trying to meet, if you have outcomes you're trying to get in the classroom, I can't imagine a scenario where you couldn't apply that kind of an approach. I think as long as the rewards are not the game itself, not winning the game itself, but towards an end goal of understanding.
I think we learned a bit about this question. So we also offer this online course on the Project Zero website for teachers to engage with the pedagogy of play. And what often comes up there is this introduction, kind of teachers want to introduce play into the classroom. And the first thing that happens is they introduce options to the class, or they try to gamify something to make it a competition. And I'm always a bit sensitive about that, because I think it's very important to think carefully about if you want to introduce options or choices into the classroom. So options is you can do either A or B. Choice can be something a bit more kind of, it's the choice of choosing A or B. Or you can think about it differently and introduce, students can find a way to solve a task on their own. So we have these license to hack cards, which I think is a wonderful example of it. So instead of telling the student you can do this task alone or in a team, you can also offer them a license to hack and say, if you can find a way to do something differently that would make sense for you while you're still learning what you're intended to do, then please do that and hack your learning in a way that makes sense to you. And I think that is what I would think about as choice much more than the options that are given. And I think a worry I always have with gamifying something is that we need to be very sensitive about who does it play feel playful to. So competition can be very joyful for those that win. We need to carefully think about it's if the goal is winning, is that the goal is learning, like kind of what is happening there. And also what happens kind of to the overall context. Do students really feel agency in the process, or is it just another way to kind of set up a frame for them to do something? And I think it can work really well, but there's some sensitivities I always have with gamifying something without considering the consequences.
I once talked to a Spanish teacher who said he only introduces elements of competition if it's in a group context. So he wouldn't do individually competitive games, but if you're on a team and playing against another team, he felt like that would be okay. And I think the other distinction that might be useful here is, as in our indicators, we're always asking, what does playful learning look like and what does it feel like? And you're not going to know how it feels unless you ask the learners. So that would be an important reflection component to gamification if it doesn't exist already.
I think that's interesting, because even from a cultural perspective, competition might feel very appropriate in one setting. And it came up in some of our indicators in some of the countries, mm-hmm. and it did not come up in other countries. So I think it's also just important to know the context that you're in.
I think so. Yeah, that is the exact same thought I was thinking. Culturally, that can be very different across, and that can be very different across schools. So being very sensitive that you don't apply, like, something that you might think is Danish might be not specifically represented at your school, that has a different school culture. And this leads to me to something that I've been really wondering about and inspired by, is this idea of conflict in play. And our colleagues at Opal School have been really doing wonderful work thinking about playing with conflict. So not thinking about conflict as something inherently bad, but a wonderful opportunity to learn to problem solve, to set boundaries, to navigate through language ways to kind of negotiate spaces. So my toy and your toy comes up a lot, I think. So I think that the gamifying also introduces conflict a lot, and being very sensitive. So if you do that, being aware of how you can actually support students in solving it themselves.
Yeah. And I think also having set up the conditions in the classroom where that feels safe for students and feels comfortable for students. So setting up those conditions where there are opportunities to disagree, there's opportunities for conflict, but there's an awareness of how to work through that in respectful ways and in positive ways.
Yeah, and acknowledging if it doesn't go that way. So I've been using do-overs since I've read about them and I saw them in the classroom. So acknowledging if you're want to have a do-over of doing something again. You felt like something didn't grow well. I might have not solved a problem as well as I thought I could. And then just stopping in that moment and saying, hey, can we have a do-over? This didn't work well. And modeling that for your students, because I think if they can do that in the classroom, feel safe to do so, a lot of conflict can be negotiated.
Yeah. It's also helpful in marriages.
Oh, yes. Wonderful. Then I think we'll wrap up this episode on thinking together in our little team meeting. And to end, I thought it would be nice to ask you if there was something that surprised you in our research that you didn't think play was or play wasn't. Because I was really surprised how serious play could be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I was just thinking, I think in my original conception of play, it looked a certain way. And that had to do with, again, smiles or at the very least, contentment, satisfaction. And it's really made me think this idea of being frustrated or working through a challenge or looking at kind of an arc of an experience that ends up being playful for a student. But if you took snapshots in the moment, it might not look like your traditional idea of play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe I think this has come up in different contexts, but the connection to nature of learning through play was something that I hadn't really thought about before, but it makes a kind of intuitive sense. But I certainly would want to understand more about what that entails.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening. I hope you have a playful week ahead of you, wherever you are right now. And we'll hear you soon. The podcast is produced and hosted by Savannah Schulz. Sound design, production and editing by Kirsi Tilk. The podcast has been funded by the Aarhus University Research Foundation. A big thank you to them for making this project possible. And a playful thank you to you for listening.